Welcome to All Things Business for Physicians, where I chat with marketers, accountants, physicians, and consultants to talk about everything like social media, office culture, running your medical practice, and how to align marketing and operations. If you're looking to grow your practice, get access to our patient acquisition and retention framework at hip.agency. Now I'd like to welcome today's featured guest, David Staughton. David is a scientist, author, and an award-winning businessman who makes doing business easier. So, David, are you ready to share your story and talk about delivering a VIP patient experience?
Absolutely. Luke, it's my passion. That's the one thing I love talking about.
Great. So take a moment to introduce yourself and give us a glimpse into your personal life.
Sure. My name's David Staughton, and I'm based in Melbourne, Australia. And many years ago, I started off as a geologist and a scientist, and I worked for five of Australia's biggest mining companies before I left and I went into the hospitality business. And I bought wedding reception venues, and I grew a large group of venues where people would hold their wedding. And I ended up with a whole lot of those and employed 200 people and did that for 15 years and about 2,500 weddings. And then in 2001, I retired, and then I started to coach and grow other businesses. And I got involved in small businesses and coaching them. And then from there, it got involved in groups of businesses. And then I got onto the speaking circuit for about 10 or 12 years. And about 5 years ago, I had been doing a few medical businesses, but 5 years ago, I got involved with a plastic surgeons group, and I partnered with the owner. And the pair of us have been growing that group for the last 5 years. And that's about takes about my time. And that's my background. So I'm passionate about what the plastic surgeons do and indeed what most doctors do. And I applied all of my experience in growing other businesses and hospitality. And my favorite thing is to improve the patient experience or the customer experience. And I use those techniques and all my business experience to improve the medical business.
That's awesome. So let's talk about that for a little bit. What makes or breaks a great medical experience, the patient experience, really? Why do so many practices struggle with providing an exceptional experience?
Well, every business that I've ever seen is a reflection of the mindset or the brain of the leader and the boss. And one of the problems that I found in working with a large group of GP practices, which is general practitioners or doctor's practices, was that it was really not obvious as to who exactly is running the business. So you have the doctor or the surgeon who is generally speaking very, very busy seeing patients and looking after all of the pre and post work to do with the patients. And then it sort of falls to the practice manager. And my perception there is that, you know, who exactly is running this practice? Whereas in other businesses, the sort of boss sits in the boss office and looks at all the analysis and does all of the numbers and, you know, really works on the team management and the leadership and the coaching and all those things that make a business run. Interestingly, in most doctors' businesses, that falls to the practice manager, who sometimes is the spouse or the wife, and sometimes it's just somebody who was a nurse that got promoted to the role. So many times the doctor is too busy to lead the practice, and the practice manager is either underpaid or unwilling or underskilled to lead the practice. So they're the issues that I find with why the patient experience possibly isn't as good as it could be in some practices.
Sure. And to kind of further that, how important is having the right team, you know, behind the doctor and behind the manager?
Well, this is probably the most important thing that I've discovered. It's that sometimes we don't put much effort into recruitment. And I was exactly guilty of this in my first ever business. And they call it warm body recruitment. You know, if you've got a pulse, you're in. So sometimes we're sort of desperate. And when people start off, they hire the 3 F's when they're just sort of starting out in business. They do the 3 F recruitment, which is called family, fools, and friends, which is trying to find, you know, oh, my wife is spare or my daughter is spare, good, she can be the receptionist, or fools, which is, you know, they go and find unemployed people, and some of them are unemployed for a reason. And then other than that, they just find unemployed friends, and they that's what they do. And look, I did the same thing. You just started with who's handy Whereas what we do now is, you know, put a lot of effort into recruitment, because the best one out of three is probably much, much better than the best one out of 10 or the best one out of 50. Also, you know, traditionally you try and take people and, you know, people with really, really good attitude and then train new skills in them. But most doctors, and especially smaller practices, are just so busy that there's no time to sort of train people up from scratch. So they typically try and get other people's staff with, and there's an awful lot to learn. You have to learn, obviously, the practice management system. You have to learn all about how you go about doing things, your personal processes and preferences, and then of course all of the things about the type of medicine that you're working with, and all the hospitals and everything else. So it is an enormous learning curve, and sadly we just kind of go with we don't put enough effort into recruitment, induction, training, no time for meetings. And if there are, they're sort of usually complaint meetings, and certainly no time for objectives much and things. And as a result of which, the business struggles.
Yeah, definitely. We see this all the time, and, you know, have seen this a little bit. I'm sure you've seen it in your own businesses, and we've seen it in ours. This stuff is really key. Having a process to bring in people, first recruit them, right? So actually take interviews. And then, do you have standard operating procedures in place to train them well on your processes, meet with them regular, review, set goals? You know, it's easier said than done for sure, but if you want to have the right team and utilize the team and get them to peak performance, it's pretty necessary.
Yeah, the big issue that we've been having lately, and I saw it with lots of, I've gone around now and visited probably 100 plastic surgeons around Australia, and now a whole lot of bariatric surgeons and other surgeons as well. And they've literally got one of everything. So they might have, you know, one practice manager, they might have one nurse, they might have one receptionist, they might have one dermal clinician or something like that, or another person. And the problem with that is that if one leaves and you have to replace them, well, really there's no one to train them, because you've got these sort of wildly different people there, unless you've got a larger practice, in which case you've got two or three or four of them. And we've been very blessed now that we've got seven plastic surgeons. So we have about 50 staff, and we're now starting to have significant numbers to make really creating the systems and doing the training with them, and then they start to become a learning group. And so we'll have a meeting with all of our patient liaison and nurses, and we might have 20 in the meeting, and they will contribute all of their ideas, and it's really powerful. Whereas, to be fair, if you're just one surgeon with five helpers, all different ones, and some of them running different businesses in there, so you might have injectables, you might have other areas of the business, it's really hard to recruit and train one person in that role if that person leaves.
Yeah, definitely. Thanks for sharing that. Let's talk a little bit more about the experience. Do most practices track and monitor how staff engage with patients?
Sort of vaguely. I think they mostly run on complaints more than anything, which is if someone complains, then we'll kind of do something. I was lucky that when I came to this particular practice, they had been for a long time doing being professionally surveyed. All of their patients had got a very extensive survey, and they had that data, and we've been continuing that on a quarterly basis. We get about 40 to 50% of the people will fill out the survey. And that gave us very, very, very insightful information about what was happening throughout the entire process. Since then, we've sped something up a little bit, because sometimes those surveys would take a while. You would survey them at the end of the complete surgery process and some of the recovery processes. We started to do SMS feedbacks on every single interaction with the patient. So if they came in for a consultation or for a review, they would get an SMS saying, on a scale of 1 to 5, would you rate us? How would you rate us? And if they rated us 5-star, then we would also send them a thing saying, well, that's fantastic. Would you like to put that onto Facebook or Google? And here are the links. And that got us a lot of online reviews. But equally, if they scored us 1 to 4 stars, they said, okay, well, you know, if there was one thing we could have done better, what would it be? And, you know, your feedback will go to the practice manager, and the practice manager will call you. And so we've been really, really working hard to work on what is it that causes the low scoring interactions. And between that and the substantial quantitative data and qualitative data we get from the bigger surveys, it's very good. I can actually give you, interestingly, the top 10 dissatisfactions. I thought you might ask this question.
Sure.
Luke, this was interesting. We had it at a conference. I've had it at two conferences where this fellow's presented, and it's the basis of, I think it's 60,000 surveys across all practices in Australia, and these were the top 10, and it was pretty simple. Fix these 10, and it's easy to say but hard to do, but the top 10, in no particular order, but these were the top 10 most complained about things by patients, and they were initial inquiry or subsequent calls or messages were not returned. Just on that note, we've recently done a mystery shop of 50 plastic surgeons in our city. Only 15 of them responded to the inquiry. So we did a mystery shop with a patient. So 15 out of 50 responded. The other 35, no response. So I'm sure they're having a bit of a tough time in their market, or they're extraordinarily busy, one or the other. But, you know, they clearly don't want any more patients. The second one was... hard to make an appointment or a long lead time. Some surgeons think it's a point of pride that, you know, I'm booked out for the next 6 months. It's interesting. It's probably that your systems are poor, your availability is low, or your prices are too cheap would be another possibility. The treatment provider was running significantly late for the appointment. Now, this is where some surgeons and doctors think that they can try and stick too much into a consult. So, you know, if you book a 45-minute consult and then you want to try and put an hour or an hour and a half's worth in there, well, it's not easy. So, but the particular thing was they're unhappy with notification and explanation. The fourth one was that the reception and admin staff were abrupt or uncaring. And this is a big one. There are some people who are really, really smiley and friendly to the doctor, but they're brutal to the customers. And one of the things you can do is do a bit of mystery shopping or do a bit of inbound calling, and you'll hear how some people have a smiley mask on and are quite unhappy underneath. And I couldn't believe it myself, but it turned out to be the case. And when the patient started to complain about, you know, various people at reception, now reception is a hard job, but nonetheless, taking it out on the patients is not called for. The other ones I like was insufficient time at the consult for treatment options or questions. So if you're trying to rush through it and you're trying to do it all at the consult, you should look at, you know, using the internet and making some videos and giving some pre-education that would work to speed up the consult and get the patients up to a higher level of knowledge rather than just turning up with no idea. Lack of transparency regarding costs is a big one. You didn't tell me how much it was going to be. They complain about the patient care in the hospital, particularly the night nurses who was looking them after them overnight, and particularly in the area of pain management and medicines. No contact with the surgeon immediately after the procedure, and some surgeons are very busy and they don't see the patients after it, and yet they love that, and especially the next of kin phone call. Difficult to get treatment advice post-procedure for medical issues or complications, which is where they have no coverage or no after-hours calls, and mistakes in billings and medical rebates and just mistakes in the accounting department. They're the top 10, and if you could fix those, your business and your career would absolutely boom, and I've seen it with all of the different surgeons and doctors that I've spoken to. So there's something.
That's awesome. Thank you for sharing that data. I want to ask you something that I didn't plan to ask you. And I've been working with several doctors who have certain barriers before allowing patients into their practice, whether it's a screening call or a long questionnaire. And some of those things can sometimes backfire, especially if you're not already busy. What's your take on that? And should you have barriers before letting people in who have requested a consult? What's your thoughts?
In the days before the internet, people would ring up and I'd say, okay, I want to see Dr. Luke, and I want to, you know, and I'd say, okay, come on Tuesday at 2:00. And literally you would start with that patient scrabbling in a little form in the foyer, and that's where you would be. It wasn't easy to do patient pre-education. But nowadays with the internet, there's absolutely no excuse to not have your patients pre-qualified and pre-educated, and in order to make your time really worthwhile. So yes, I'm seeing a lot more people. So we started a little website, and now it's an enormous website with the amount of information. It gets 50,000 hits per month to our website. We now have downloadable guides, and they're all reading the downloadable guides. And it means that when they phone up for an inquiry, or when they turn up for a consult, they are well pre-educated. And we're not talking about, you know, what is the basics. We're literally onto their particular problem. And so it makes much better use of the staff's time and for the doctor's time. So I'm a huge fan of pre-education and pre-qualifying. We also have a pre-qualification for the that the nurses or the patient advisors will ring the patient and do a pre-call and run through that we've got the registrations, the photographs, because to be fair, I have some surgeons who only have 6 consults a week. That's all they have. I have some surgeons that only have 10 per week. I have another surgeon that does 20 consults per week. And I have to defend those consults to make sure that someone doesn't come in and that's a complete waste of time. So, you know, we're a plastic surgery practice. You don't come in and just sort of say, oh, well, I've got a pimple. You know, you've just wasted everybody's time. So we are really quite efficient and friendly about making sure that we can do what you want. And we're happy to send you to other places. We're happy to recommend you to lots of other different surgeons. But really what we're trying to do is to be focused. Just on that topic, when you start out in business, and all businesses start out like this, they're not very selective, and they do what's called AAAAA, which is they do anything for anyone, anywhere, anytime, at any price whatsoever. They're pretty desperate. And, you know, they're kind of, yeah, sure, I'll give it a go, or I don't know much about it, but I'll sort of do it. And as surgeons mature, they tend to get circumspect, and they tend to focus. And with the internet now, you can really focus down and develop a niche, and you can do these things for these people, this time, this location, this price, and you can be quite specific about how you go about doing business. So there are some surgeons that are really systemized in this, like Tebbutt in plastic surgery, who have some of the most comprehensive surveys. At the conference on the weekend, there was another surgeon there called Rehnquist, and he literally got people to analyze themselves as to how satisfied they were with their body and their various things beforehand, so that afterwards, when they were, when he'd made a difference, you could see what it was. And he had some really good stuff on doing psychological evaluation, because for most of the surgeons that I've dealt with, taking the wrong patient, poor patient selection, is probably going to cause you a lot of mental grief and health. The people that are very unhappy with you, the people who you didn't get a great outcome with, the people who want to sue you, or even just complain a lot about you online, is going to take an awful lot of your mental happiness away. So anyway, so pre-selection and qualification is absolutely something I do. Sadly, it's a bit hard to do it early on, because if you don't have many customers, it's pretty hard to select them out, would be my thought, Luke.
Right, exactly. So in terms of providing a great experience for patients, is proper training usually given?
You'd like to think so, but it's pretty hard to do it. As I said, for that problem before that we have sort of lots of different staff doing different roles, it's really hard for me to train, you know, the dermal clinician, because sometimes I'm not really up to speed on that. So we do send them off to conferences and courses. We have trainers. We have in-house training. You have to even get people up to speed with your particular patient management system. We use one called Genie in Australia, but there's lots and lots of them. And this is the hardest thing. It takes an awful lot of training to get someone up to speed with this. And sadly, most training is pretty poor, because it's kind of like what's called hot dip training, which is we just give you lots of it in a big dose and then hope that you go away and implement it. So, you know, I've seen it from surgeons where we just did a 3-day conference this last weekend, and all of our surgeons get all excited and they're all really pumped and very happy and yes, yes, yes. And on Monday morning, I say, so we're going to do that technique. And they go, oh, no, we're not going to do that. And I go, well, what was all that about then? And similarly, we spend an awful lot of people, a lot of times sending people to training courses with no outcomes, no follow-up and no implementation. You know, you don't get fit going to the one-day boot camp. What you've got to do is go and do it a little bit over a long period of time. But most training's not designed like that. It's designed for 3-day conference. It's designed for, you know, one-day workshop. So the answer to that is lots and lots and lots of little training with follow-up systems and work is required. The problem with that is the doctors and surgeons that are doing the training, they go, but, you know, what if I train them and spend all this money training them and they leave? And as one famous guy in Australia said, you know, what if you don't train them and they stay? And that's the problem.
Right. They definitely can leave, but if they're around and not trained, they're really not useful at all. So
probably especially in medicine. I've played in lots of other industries, but there's kind of, you know, you could die if we don't do a good job would be a thought. You know, if we really didn't pay attention to, you know, this person's got this problem and we didn't really, you know, note that, or we were a bit lazy in checking some things, people can die from, you know, hospital misadventures. So
sure.
Training is essential, and it's given a lot of lip service. I'm not sure it's given a lot of results. We certainly, the other one I'd also say to you, being involved in this for a long time, is that training without testing is not worth the training. That was really interesting. Lots of people will go to a conference, but on Monday morning, if there was a test or an exam about it, then you're probably going to remember more of it. Whereas a lot of them go to it and really enjoy the champagne and the canapes.
Right. There's no follow-up or discourse about it or reviews or anything. So, yeah.
Nothing. You just went on we sent you on a conference and we expected you to come back miraculously changed. You know, I sent you on a one-day boot camp and now I'm expecting you to have a six-pack and look gorgeous. You know, it's kind of really, really? No, you just look tired and, you know, worn out. So, anyway. Yeah,
definitely. So why don't most doctors try to improve things that are very common that I see, scheduling hassles, wait times, rude staff, and just poor management?
It's an interesting question. We could kind of talk about the doctors are different. And maybe they are. I've dealt with a lot of doctors. Doctors are what's called mismatches. They find things that are not right and they focus on that. But they're mostly busy focusing sometimes on the wrong thing. My favorite joke at the conferences, I've probably been to about 10 plastic surgeons conferences in the last 5 years, maybe more. And my favorite thing is that they are spending hours and hours and hours and hours on stitching techniques and, you know, literally possibilities of different, you know, complications and little tiny things, and all about medicine and more medicine. And then there's somebody will be giving a talk in the other room on how to get more patients or how to communicate with patients better or something, and no one will go and attend that talk. And it's amazing that, you know, anything to do with the business or communications or staff, they go, oh, I've outsourced that to the nurse or the patient manager. I am doing the medicine part. And my favorite joke, and you're welcome to share it, is that, you know, the doctors there at these conferences, they have mastered the Kama Sutra, but they have no girlfriends. You know, they are literally fantastic at the medicine. They're just not very good at the other bit of medicine, which is possibly the, you know, the patient communication. And nowadays, the patients are very, very demanding, and that's the bit you really have to work on, the staffing bit, how to make your team work. The millennial staff are much more demanding, and they're not prepared to take the old way of, you know, I'm the doctor and you're my surgeon and you do what I say. That's just not working anymore. There's been a complete shift in generation. So I deal with a lot of older doctors and they're really not up for it. They're not up for the new modern way of doing business in some people.
And so if those doctors aren't up for it, as long as they identify it and bring someone else in who is up for it, is that okay? Or does a doctor really need to be versed in it as well?
Well, some of the issues we have are interesting. Some of the doctors think that it's still the 1980s where it's okay to sort of pinch the bottom of the nurses and things like that. And it's like, hello, this is, you know, that went out 20 years ago. So, you know, marrying the nurse and or, you know, ditching the wife and trying to, you know, have the new nurse be the new wife, that's where a lot of doctors are at, and that's where most nurses became the practice manager and or the wife. But interestingly, are they willing to change? Behavioral change is quite a complex thing and very slow. So I'm not sure whether some of them are willing to change is an issue. And if they are, it's usually a little bit. But there's been a significant value shift into what people's expectations are now, and some doctors are not up for that, which is what's fair and reasonable. They literally, many of them in hospitals were taught by a fear-based model. They were literally, you know, scared by the person who taught them, and literally embarrassed and humiliated. And it's quite an interesting method to train people, but it's not one that's working and is popular at the moment. So there's been a shift now in what millennials expect. The classic with this is, you know, should any of the staff be playing with a mobile phone during the workplace, you know, is an interesting question. So most millennials go, I have my phone with me on all the time, and I'm literally, you know, doing a lot of my personal stuff at the same time as that I'm doing my work stuff. Whereas the old surgeons all think that it's, you know, the old days, and where you just come in and just totally only do your work. And we have a bit of a, you know, multi-generational values clash around that.
I don't know how I would live without my phone.
So that's it. So, you know, so it's an interesting one. So therefore we want none, and, you know, no one at the front desk should be having their phone. So, you know, what are the phone rules? But nowadays is that the patients are all talking to you on Facebook, and I know they're using WhatsApp, which is a secure line. Some surgeons are talking directly to their patients on WhatsApp and Instagram. One of the most successful surgeons in Australia does an hour and a half on Instagram every day, talks to all of his patients, who literally post everything live for everybody to see.
Yeah. And I'm not sure with Facebook Messenger, I don't think that's HIPAA compliant, but obviously for acquisitions, I mean, yeah, you could definitely have a scheduler on her phone a lot, because it's easier to chat on Facebook Messenger with people who might be interested. So I think it's just about having some type of policy in place to try and maximize them when they are on their phone, to be on their phone for your business. But again, easier said than done, but a lot of those could even be found online, you know, a social media or mobile phone policy. Look at that and try and implement something that works for your business. That's what I would suggest.
Look, it's interesting. We have in Australia the medical board. You have obviously the same in the States. But the people who sit on the medical board are mostly old and really out of touch with society. To be fair, I don't know your medical board, but our medical board is old. And what's happening with the old medical board is that they do not realize that the people who are, you know, patients between, you know, 15 to 25, young ones, they do everything on the phone. So they don't use the telephone. They don't use email. They use Facebook Messenger. They use WhatsApp. They use Snapchat. And this is an interesting thing. That's their communication tool. So we in Australia about 2 years ago had an issue with some surgeons, and as a result of which the medical board said, you're now not allowed to use testimonials, patient testimonials, and you're not allowed to use, you're not allowed to advertise finance for surgery. So, and again, that came in 2 years ago, and you go, well, that's interesting, but, you know, I deal with this a lot, and many patients don't have the money to pay for surgery, and they use finance, and they say, well, we're not allowed to talk about it or advertise it. And similarly with testimonials, and there's some fabulous articles on this that said testimonials are what patients decide as to who they will trust and use. And so we're not allowed to use testimonials. You are in America, they're not allowed to in Canada. So it's interesting who is deciding these rules and what value set, because that's their value set, you know, oh, well, you shouldn't use testimonials, or you shouldn't use Facebook Messenger. Facebook Messenger now is the hottest channel for talking to patients, and so people are using Facebook bots, but they go, oh, well, I wouldn't use that. And I'm sure you wouldn't. You'd prefer to use Telex, well, you know, fax machine, or, you know, some other old technology, but that's okay. You know, but it's interesting. If you want to deal with younger patients, you've got to go with the flow. So anyway, we'll see.
Oh yeah. You got to stay up with the times for sure. So what's the best patient experience you've personally seen, and how is it implemented?
Recently I've been out visiting doctors. All my family has a history of varicose veins. So I went out and I asked our surgeons who I should go and see, and they sent me to go and see him, and he was without doubt excellent. And he is probably, you know, I haven't had it done yet, but I went and experienced his experience, and he was fantastic, but he just focused on what was my problem and how he was going to solve it. What he didn't give me particularly was any education. He was poor in explaining the pricing. The process was pretty brutal. Come in here, stand there, sit there, do this, do that, get this, take your clothes off, boom, boom, boom. And it was really perfunctory. Whereas the second one that I went to see, because I thought I'd go and do some mystery shopping and be a patient. I've seen three surgeons now. I've got one more to see. He literally greeted me at the front door. He then explained to me what he was going to do and reassured me that everything was going to be all right. And then he went and did the first examination. And then after that, he gave me a complete education about how it all worked and what he was going to do. Then he did the process. Then he brought in another colleague who replicated that and got a second opinion. And then he walked me right the way through the process in great detail about how it was going to be done, how it was going to be paid for, and So he did literally education, examination, explanation. He explained the pricing. He justified why the prices were like that and what he could do. And all the way he built rapport, he asked me how I felt. He was just probably one of the best that I have ever seen. That was what he did. Whereas, as I said, and then I've had a third one since then who was, again, just perfunctory. He came in, he said, this is what he's going to do. This is how much it's going to cost. That was it. No rapport building, no education, nothing. And certainly in the before and the after, sadly, none of those guys were particularly good at either directing you to a guide, downloadable guide or their website or anything like that, or any, there are no pre-calls. It was just, you know, turn up at this time. So, but that's the best I've seen so far as a patient, what I'm looking for. Bit of education, bit of examination, bit of explanation, a bit of empathy. Certainly, it's interesting to see whether the pricing should be talked about by the doctor or by the assistants. That's an interesting one. A lot of surgeons don't have price confidence and won't or can't talk about it. And then the ability to justify the price or sell the value of why they're different and better. Now, the price range for those vein surgery for the same surgery was $1,500 to $15,000. That's been the price range difference at the moment. So wildly different. And I've heard the same thing for much of the plastic surgery in Australia and in other places, sometimes double, triple, quadruple the price. So pricing and price transparency is very low in the surgery business.
Yeah, it's interesting here in the States, you know, the experience you'll get if you go to something that is elective versus insurance, like I broke my ankle or foot, you know, because usually the insurance guy doesn't really have to focus on a great experience, because if you break your foot, you got to go somewhere, right? Whereas with plastic surgery, if you want injections or breast aug or something like that, you need to be pampered, or most people are expecting to be, right? It's more of a, what we're talking about, VIP patient experience. But funny enough, one of the best experiences I see is a surgeon here who is a foot and ankle surgeon, and he probably spends 5 minutes in the room with the patient. But I think it's the whole thing. He, like what we're talking about, he's trained his staff, he educates his patients, and he builds rapport with them while he is in the room. And yes. I mean, you should see the reviews that this guy gets. I mean, it's just, it's crazy. You know, he can spend 5 minutes with someone, but he's able to connect with them. And that's really everything.
So you're absolutely correct. And this is what I was interested in. And in doing this with a surgeon that I partnered with, I worked out what he was doing. And then I looked at other surgeons and have seen the difference. And as I've gone around to see lots of plastic surgery practices all around Australia, you get to see, and success leaves clues. What is this person doing that makes them really successful? But most surgeons don't have much time to go and do that. And they certainly don't go and look at their business. They usually just go to surgery with them and learn more about techniques. Sadly, as I mentioned there, it's really about getting really, really good at less and less. So, you know, pick your niches and get really good at it and then systemize and process it. Someone gave me, I think it was Atul Gawande who wrote his books on systems. Somewhere in one of his articles, he said that the cost of open heart surgery in America is $250,000. And in India, they're doing it for $1,200, and they're getting better results in India for $1,200. And what they've done is that they've systemized it, and they've worked out what everybody does. So they've done it in the most efficient way. And we're in the same boat in Australia. You know, it's about making everybody, you know, that the patient experience is really, really important. And the better you do it, the easier your job's going to be. So happiness for most doctors is a full waiting room, but really a full waiting room is not what patients want. They want to be really looked after, and they want the bespoke and experience. Now, I appreciate the insurance companies just want people to, you know, be processed, but you can still do that in a very, very efficient way. And nowadays with education and training, you can do an awful lot of it. So the ones with the best patient experience have the best patients. They get raved about, they get loved, they get lots of word of mouth, and they have a happy life, and they've done and made a lot of difference, and they attract really, really good patients. What happens if you're really brutal to your patients, which is that, you know, you keep them waiting and you're rude to them and you're angry and stuff, then you get a lot of the worst patients that, you know, rejected by others, and as a result of which your life is harder. So, you know, depends what you want.
Definitely.
I've gone down the premium, high quality patient experience range, and I've done it with lots and lots of businesses, and we turned them into multi-million dollar successes. You know, classic in America, I study a lot of the books by Cleveland Clinic and the Mayo Clinic, and how well some of those guys have focused, Cleveland Clinic's particularly focused on patient experience.
Someone I've recently studied is Quint Studer. I'm not sure if you have ever heard of him, but he created a group, the Studer Group, that focuses on the experience for hospitals. Yes. He recently sold the business, but has several books, and it's a lot like what you're talking about.
Sadly, in Australia, there's a book by Porter called Redefining Healthcare, and that's the one that they're using to... we had an all-you-can-eat health food model in Australia, and it's now becoming a following the American and the UK and the New Zealand model of becoming highly, what would you say, economically rational, as in that they're just cutting everything. So we're going down that path at the moment. So it'll be interesting to see the hospitals under a lot of pressure in Australia, because the health funds have been listed onto the stock market and are now just going, we don't want to pay. So we're seeing a lot of the codes, rebates and hospital fees all being cut back. So that's where we're at.
Yep.
And so therefore, you know, there'll be an opportunity for other people to charge, and people are willing to pay for the patient experience, because as the others get cut things away. One hospital I went to in interstate, they called me in to do team building with the staff. And I said, I interviewed a few of the staff, and they said that the accountant had cut the coffee in the hospital. They'd made the staff bring their own Nescafe coffee.
Wow.
I'm going, what? Don't run that past me again. You're making all the staff. It was a big hospital for 1,000 people, and they had to cut the supply of coffee to all of the staff, and you were now expected to bring your own coffee, as in the Nescafe, the instant coffee.
Yeah, that's just crazy.
And they were all unhappy, and therefore they had, you know, disengaged staff, and that's why they wanted to talk to me about, you know, team building exercise. I said, just save your money and put the coffee back on. really, just have, you know, okay, you know, how much were you saving with the coffee? You know,
sorry. Yeah, take your fee and just buy some coffee.
don't hire me. Just, you know, you're clearly too stupid to hire a consultant. You know, just put the coffee back on. Just, you know, save the $5,000, you know, team building session and put the coffee back on.
So we're at the end, and it's time to speed things up a little bit. What's the best advice you've ever been given in terms of customer experience?
Pain is 19 times the motivating factor of pleasure. So the fastest thing you can do to improve your customer experience is removing the ouch factor, to find out what it is that is really upsetting your customers the most. And the best way to do that was to ask your staff, because they certainly know, and ask your patients, and they absolutely know. And what we ask is, in the surveying, we'll ask, if there was one single thing we could do to improve, what would it be? And start with that. And it can be as simple as that the toilets smell. You asked me before what was, you know, one of the best patient experience I'd ever had. The guy that was charging $15,000 for the vein work had his gel that he used to do the ultrasound in a little warmer pot. And it meant that when he put the gel on, it wasn't freezing cold.
So he thought about everything.
He thought about everything. He had literally gone, and for the cost, and it was basically a baby bottle warming thing, and it held his little jar of gel. And obviously, as a sonographer or an ultrasound guy, he's smearing, you know, layers of it on. And I reckon there's an awful lot of ultrasounders and sonographers out there that are basically putting cold gel, you know, lubricant on people when they're doing the sonography. So the answer there is, you find out what that one thing is, and, you know, how difficult it is, and then you brainstorm how we can fix it. Now, some of them are more intractable, like those things, you know, why is the doctor running late all the time? But there's some other simple ones, such as, you know, the toilet seems to smell, or it's, you know, the patients are not getting their paperwork in advance or whatever. If the patients don't get it, it's usually if the failure is, if the communication is on our part, not on their part, we haven't made it simple enough and dumb enough. My favorite one, having interviewed lots of our doctors, is that they'll do a 1-hour consultation. And then at the end of it, I said, we did a survey of the patients, do you reckon that they got what you talked about? And the research says maybe, you know, 1 or 2% will of the information that was put across. So we've got to make it simpler and easier and effective. Smarten it down That's, you know, and that's one of the best ways to improve your customer experience. They didn't get it. It's not their fault that they didn't, you know, they didn't read the sign that said, you know, don't take your bandage off straight after surgery. They're not following the instructions. The instructions were unclear. So we have to make it simpler. You know, should we provide an app? Should we provide, you know, great big, you know, laminated sheets and things? Well, you've got to find them the method that they work. So you find out what the problems are, and then you try multiple solutions to see if we can come up with a solution for it. And then my best one, of course, is share that with all of your colleagues as well in the industry.
So sure. Thank you. What's a personal habit that contributes to your success?
When I first started in business, I had no idea what I was doing, and I was really lucky that I read a book. In the book, I found in a junk shop, and it was How to Win Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie. And that book truly made me my first $1 million. And ever since then, I've been a bookaholic and a learningaholic. And I go to conferences, I take notes, I implement some of it, I go and read it. As I'm sitting here talking to you, I've got 5,000 business books in my library. I've read lots of them, and I'm just absolutely committed to lifelong learning. And finding out, and success leaves clues. And my favorite guy is Richard Koch, who is the 80-20 principle guy. 20% of what you do gets you 80% of your results. So keep on working on the important few things, and rather than the insignificant thousands of things. So that's what I work on, the big stuff. What are the big rocks?
Awesome. Can you share an internet resource that helps you?
The most useful ones that I've found lately is that there's somebody called Green Branch Publishing, and they have evidently put in a lot of really, really niche books and resources for particularly American medical, but I find them quite useful for Australia, given that we are going down the American medical pathway. They're certainly very helpful to me. So they have a whole stack of books dealing with the tiny issues of different types of medicine. They publish maybe more than a couple of hundred books, and Greenback Publishing, the books have been very, very niche and very, very targeted. They're so very useful. My favorite thing in reading a book is that someone's usually put 10 years of pain and suffering into that book. So, you know, you might as well take the time to read that book. If it's the right book for you, it's the thing that will really save you an awful lot of trouble in your life. So reading through Green Branch Publishing. And the other person we got onto who was probably the best I've seen, has done 20 years of practice management, was Catherine Maley, who sells some online learning things. So we're able to get some self-training. She sold it for about $2,000. Webinars for staff to go through how to improve your practice. And it's been really powerful. So that's that one. So that was Catherine Maley, and her online learning systems have been quite really useful, because that way, if you hire a new staff member, we ran it through for the group, and we run it every so often for the group, but we literally run them for any new person that joins us to get them up to speed with what our expectations are. So I quite like those.
Share one book you'd recommend and why.
No, I'll probably give you two. Sorry about that. But the first one, we've had a couple of dentists in Australia that really, really, really had a miraculous flip to delivering phenomenal patient experience. And the original guy was in Queensland, a guy called Paddy Lund, L-U-N-D. But more recently, there's been another surgeon who I found on the speaking circuit, a doctor called Dr. David Moffat, M-O-F-F-E-T. And he runs a website called theultimatepatientexperience.com. And his book was called How to Build the Dental Practice of Your Dreams Without Killing Yourself in Less Than 60 Days. And I've used that book with all of our surgeons, and they've all read it. And they literally, for some of them, got the message that maybe they should be nicer to people during the consults and improve their patient experience. And it's been a very profound book for that. He also talks about in that book about a thing called the onboard terrorist. Who is it that's in your practice that is absolutely killing your practice? And it can be the wicked person on the front desk, could be the practice manager, could be the nurse, but he says there's somebody in there that just doesn't want to do it and is literally limiting and minimizing your practice, and they are your onboard terrorist. Who is it that's stopping your practice from growing? And certainly we had a few of those in our practice.
I have a question about that real sure. quick. Sure. When you recognize that, what do you do, and how fast do you do it?
Well, what I typically do is that, much like cutting out a cancer, you would try and cut that cancer out, but that's much easier said than done. We have rules in Australia that you're not allowed to terminate people. So in fact, it takes many years to remove some people. But if you really were choice, you basically go through your exit strategy policy, which is, you know, three warnings for doing the wrong thing. The main thing is that you become aware of it, or you start to study what exactly is going on. So you might want to do, some people do patient recording, or sorry, recording of the inbound patient calls. But basically you have to go through some sort of termination process. But it's really hard because some of them are really passive aggressive. Some of them are just smiley to the surgeon or the doctor, but really, really nasty to the patients. And this is where you want to be cautious. You want to get patient feedback about those situations and take action on it. But to be fair, most doctors and others don't. They just keep on walking along with a stone in their shoe because the pain of change is sometimes more painful than the pain of keeping that person. So that's the problem. But, you know, there it is. If you want to go fast, you can't go fast or walk far with a stone in your shoe. And there are a lot of issues. Some people, Jack Welch, I think, calls it weed out the week, and the guy in Australia calls it colour crap, which is that he gets rid of the bottom 10% of the staff every year.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
That's brutal. But, you know, that's if you want to do it, do it. Because one of the amazing things is that the rest of the staff all come to you and go, oh, yes, we're just so relieved that you got rid of that person. They've just been so, you know, terrible to us and for others. And it literally is like, you know, unfurling an anchor and the boat just goes faster. So,
yeah, well, usually when the people at the top realize the onboard terrorist, as you call it, everybody else has already realized it. Because they're working next to them a lot of times, you know? So yeah. I think, yeah, that is the case. That's interesting.
Yeah. And look, again, always sadly, the culture is a reflection of the mindset of the boss and all of the people that are there and every little behavior that they have. And that sort of reflects in the engagement levels of the staff. But it's interesting. As a general rule in medical, the staff are a lot more underappreciated compared to hospitality, retail, and other industries that I found. The doctors and things are more, as I said, mismatches. They'll tell you always what you've done wrong. They're not always as good on the telling you things you've done right. There's a rule in really successful businesses that they have a 3-to-1, 3 praise and appreciations to 1 disciplining or negative feedback. Some people call it also the good news, bad news, good news sandwich, which is I give you some good news. You know, Luke, you did a fantastic job on this report, but next time, you know, see if you could use the spell checker. But other than that, it was really good and I appreciate you doing it. You know, so it's good news, bad news, good news type stuff. Whereas some surgeons just come in and go, Luke, there's 6 spelling mistakes in this report. You know, okay, thanks. You know, I stayed up all night and did it and rushed and got it done in 3 days to meet your deadline and stuff like that. But, you know, no appreciation for that. So most surgeons and doctors' practices do not run particularly much on appreciation. So
definitely. So let's end this thing by you telling listeners how they can get in touch with you.
I'm in Australia. I have several websites, but an easy one to get me on is Big Hat. So www.bighat.com.au. I also have another one. I'm davidstorton.com, but come to Big Hat. It's easy to remember. And that's probably about it. Oh, I did mention one other quick book. The best book that I've ever found on marketing your practice is a Drive by a plastic surgeon called Steve Dayan, Dayan. And the book was called Drive. And it was without doubt the absolutely comprehensive in full color book on how to market your practice. It was awesome. So many people have not seen it. It's about $100, but it was an excellent, excellent book on how the complete guide to how he's marketed his practice. So very good.
So give us some final words. What's the best advice you can tell doctors and managers who are struggling to create a VIP patient experience?
One of the things I first started in this business was that I interviewed all of the surgeons that were 70 and 80, and I wanted some lessons as to what they'd learned. To be a plastic surgeon or a real specialist in Australia takes you to about the age of 40 to 45 to get to be one. And then they were doing about 20 years of work, and then they were sort of being thought they could retire at 65, 70, 75. Some sort of did part-timing from there. The big lesson for the VIP patient experience was that you only have about, you only live so many years, you only have work about 20 to 25 good years, make it the best possible experience you could have. So focus on the patients and focus on improving the systems, and that will improve the staff, and it'll bring a lot more joy to your life and your practice. I met a lot of surgeons who got up every morning before their kids, came home after their kids were in bed, and they'd found that during their life they had had a terrible relationship with their kids and their wife, and pretty much all their entire life was just medicine, 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 medicine. And nowhere along the way had they worked out that they should, you know, have had perhaps a better time and then spent some more loving time with their families and things. So we had a little bit of this, a glimpse of it at the conference. Two of the surgeons gave a 5-minute talk each on what they do outside of medicine. That's the game. There's no prize for doing lots and lots of patients and, you know, being the wealthiest, crankiest, most successful surgeon at the end. The trick is absolutely to focus on having a VIP patient experience so that you're enjoying every minute of it. If you're as happy as you are at work as you are at home, then that's a good thing. So, you know, don't come to work if it's a miserable place. Go and find or do something about it. Go and find a better place. That would be my thought.
Wow. David, thank you so much for coming on the show. This has been incredible, and I know physicians are going to learn a lot. So thank you.
No worries at all. Thanks, Luke. Thanks for the opportunity. I look forward to seeing you at a conference in the future. So we'll catch up.
Okay, listeners, I hope this helped. We'd love to know what you thought about today's podcast. So shoot me an email at luke@hipcreativeinc.com and let me know things you are implementing from today's episode. Also, if you have any ideas on topics or just ideas for the podcast in general, let me know. To learn more about Hip Creative, head over to hip.agency. Thank you so much.